Trigger warning. This podcast contains more common sense than most people can cope with. If you can't handle the truth, stop listening now. The conservative revolution starts here. This is your weekly dose of common sense with Corey Bernardi.
Hello, everyone. This is Corey Bernardi. Welcome to another weekly dose of common sense podcast. Great to have you tuning in. And hasn't it been an interesting week? There's so much to cover, so this podcast could be a little longer than it normally is. But, you know, some of you will like that and some won't. Just like some of you responded positively, understandingly, and some less so, about the decision not to proceed with the Australian Conservatives. It was a huge announcement. It took a long time for me to come to that conclusion, but it's the only logical conclusion that I could come to. So much was invested in the Australian Conservatives. We put so much work into making a professional party by having good staff, the best systems, providing the technology that we thought would give us an edge. And in the end, we found ourselves in no man's land. We weren't crazy enough to get the unhappy voters who just want someone to complain. We weren't niche enough to get the voter who wants to have marijuana legalised or animals given human rights. Yes, we were beaten by the vegans and the stoners. And the mainstream conservative message was reclaimed by the coalition. Full marks to Scott Morrison for that. I understand it perfectly. If you're not a financial member of the Australian Conservatives, or you weren't, you wouldn't have been sent an email about it. You can go to conservatives.org.au, read the statement there. But overwhelmingly, the feedback I received from the members was understanding. It was an appreciation of the frankness in which I assessed the matters leading to the deregistration of the party. It was a very tough call, make no doubt about it. But I also know it was the right call because I've seen everything that happens in the background of the party. I'm not going to go over the entrails of all the stuff that goes on. I understand exactly how difficult it is and debilitating it is to run an organisation with, at its peak, 22,000 members, to process tens of thousands of small donations, to respond to hundreds of thousands of emails, and be doing all that in a political environment. But the brutal reality is, you could justify continuing that. You could probably say, yeah, we can rationalise things and make it more efficient if we had some modicum of electoral success. But we've been going backwards. From the very first outing, every single election post that has taken us backwards, because our reason for being, the reason we were formed, was because the Liberal Party was lurching so hard to the left under Malcolm Turnbull. Now, it's easy for you to say, well, you might think that, you know, they're not perfect, and they're not. But the rationale is that we should be supporting them as hard as we can rather than trying to tear them down. Had they lost the election, let's be frank about this, had the coalition lost the election, they would have torn themselves to pieces and the Australian Conservatives would have had some legs going into it. But they didn't. Anyway, lots of feedback about it. There were lots of questions. I'll cover some of those in Your Say a bit later on, and that'll be a pretty lengthy one as well. I hope you find it interesting. But primarily, people have said, are you going to keep writing? Are you going to keep doing your podcast? The answer to that is, yes, that's my intention. I'm going to keep plugging away at that as a means of communication to get some common sense out into the community. Now, if you don't want to be part of that, click the unsubscribe link on the email that's been sent to you. Just click it. Don't have to send some rant or tyrant or all caps abuse to me. Just click the unsubscribe link. Let's all be big boys and girls and take responsibility for ourselves. Anyway, it's been a labour of love the last 2.5 years. It's been an extraordinary amount of work, but I know I'm now making a transition into a different representation, both within the political realm, but also outside of that. And I said to someone at a function the other day, you know, the culture wars which we're engaging in, the battle for ideas, it's not just a single-pointed spear that takes place in politics. It's more like a trident. There is the political point, there is the media point, and then there's the community point or the business point where everyone can play a role, whether we've got a platform in politics or the media, or we have a presence in our community, and we all have a presence in our community, no matter how small that is, to fly the flag for common sense and mainstream conservatism. And I intend to continue to do that. Firstly, as part of the political system, but ultimately, I'll make a transition out of it in the next 2 or 3 years and be pursuing something else. I'm not giving up in the culture wars. I'm not giving up in the battles because they are too important. And I want your voice, our voice, to be heard. But having said that, I reflected on making decisions. And decisions often don't make people happy. And the worst decisions are the ones in which you don't take a clear path. There is no definitive line drawn in the sand. They meander along a little bit, and so people don't know kind of where they are. And it reminded me of the very first blog that I ever wrote. October 13, I wrote a blog about an article in The Economist magazine that quite literally changed my mindset. I've carried that article with me ever since. First on my backpacking trips through Europe where I picked it up, but also I now have it framed in my office and it sits on my bookshelf where I can see it every day and be reminded of it. And it's a timeless message about making decisions. It's a little dated in some areas, the relationships about politics or some of the economics in it, but it's very brief. And once you get through that, you realize that you need to take a stand. And it was entitled Crunchiness. It was based on a column written by the late Nico Colchester. He wrote it originally in 1988. It was published a week after his death, and I picked it up in 1996. He was a former editor of The Economist magazine, and I've kept this single page for 23 years. It's quite extraordinary, actually. Colchester's premise was that crunchiness provided certainty for everyone involved. A crunchy decision is not necessarily the right one, he writes, but it leaves those impacted into no doubt as to the consequences. And that column spoke to me of the need for boldness in decision-making. Consider, decide, act became my crunchy mantra. And the process certainly doesn't mean you're going to get it all right, but it's better than drowning in a swamp of soggy uncertainty. Keeping things crunchy also means you cannot hide from the outcomes. You've got to accept responsibility. And for me, the federal election was the crunchy moment for the Australian Conservatives. Everything we did and experienced up to that point would be subsumed by the reality of how many votes we actually received. And let's just say the result left me in no doubt as to where we stood electorally. The land upon which we were trying to pitch our political tent had been seized by another tribe, and our ranks were decimated to such an extent that we couldn't justify laying claim to it anymore. Now, I'll cover more of Colchester's timeless message in the podcast. In fact, I'll read the entire article to you. It'll take a few minutes, but it's well worth listening to. You can Google it online if you would rather do that as well. Colchester, crunchiness. But he concluded by saying this: run your country or your company or your life as you think fit, but whatever you do, keep things crunchy. I'm still heeding Colchester's timeless advice after 23 years. I think it's important that we all have strength in our deliberations and we keep our decision-making crunchy. Let me know what you think. And later on the podcast, we're going to cover your say, as I mentioned, but we're also going to talk about this mythical Bradfield scheme, because last night I got into a bit of a discussion with Senator Pauline Hanson on Paul Murray Live, and it said to me that a lot of people don't understand what the Bradfield scheme actually was. And would you believe it was the very first attempt at man engineering climate change? Well, that might come as a surprise to you. We'll discuss that at length. And more on the Common Sense Podcast.
This is the home of the conservative revolution. This is your weekly dose of common sense with Corey Bernardi.
Well, friends, here it is. Some timeless wisdom and common sense from a chap named Nico Colchester. I picked up this article in 1996 when I bought a copy of The Economist magazine. It was republished a week after his death. Originally, it's from 1988. And it's called Colchester's Crunchiness. Crunchiness brings wealth. Wealth leads to sogginess. Sogginess brings poverty. Poverty creates crunchiness. From this immutable cycle, we know that to hang on to wealth, you must keep things crunchy. Crunchy systems are those in which small changes have big effects, leaving those affected by them in no doubt whether they are going up or down, rich or broke, winning or losing, dead or alive. The going was crunchy for Captain Scott as he plodded southwards across the Sastrugi. He was either on top of the snow crust and smiling or floundering thigh deep. The farther south he marched, the crunchier his predicament became. Sogginess is comfortable uncertainty. The modern Scott is unsure how deeply he is in it. He can radio for an airlift or drop in on an American early warning station for a hot toddy. The richer a society becomes, the soggier its systems get. Light switches no longer turn on or off, they dim. Intelligent questions replace the church's absolute faith. Seatbelts are worn. Words like these are not written down, but processed endlessly. Exam papers are no longer passed or failed, but graded, with no one quite sure what grade is needed for what. Some of these softnesses are the welcome accomplishments of wealth, but lurking behind sogginess lies moral hazard and systemic drama. Take the worldwide move from fixed rate money lending to floating rate loans. Fixed rate lending is crunchy. Borrower and lender commit themselves to a future view of inflation and interest rates. If interest rates rise, borrowers are heftily deterred, for no one wants to be saddled with a loan at a rotten rate. In a soggy floating rate system, no such commitment is needed. The borrower lives in hope that his interest charge will fall. He knows that it will be no higher than his neighbours and suspects there is safety in numbers. The result is a need for puzzlingly high rates of interest to curb consumer borrowing. The dangers of sogginess abound in a modern economy. Portfolio insurance, provided in a financial futures market that transfers crunchiness from hedges to speculators, gave some American investors a soggy feeling of reassurance before 1987 stock market crash. So share prices had to move horribly to undo their comfortable excesses. Soggy federal deposit insurance, coupled with a move towards a soggier interest rate regime, has taken many of America's thrifts and banks into the shadow of a systemic collapse. Dramatic bailouts are now needed. Liability insurance provided American industry with a soggy riposte to the highly unsatisfactory evolution of American tort law. Don't fight the absurd lawsuit. Let our insurers settle it out of court. Liability insurance cover has now become so expensive that whole areas of business are threatened, and the next soft-headed notion that will be no-fault insurance. No matter who is to blame, your insurers will pay up. Crunchiness is not just a facet of right-wing politics. Much of the sogginess so far mentioned was served up by the free market. The comforts of sogginess are much in demand. Stalin was crunchy in his own way. Gorbachev needs somehow to become a lot crunchier in his. Mrs. Thatcher is certainly crunchy. Her policies towards the Falkland Islands, the British Coal Mining Union, and the dwindling worth of the pound were crunchiness writ large. Inflation is acutely soggy, leeching away the wealth of savers and the obligations of debtors, transferring national income from the uncomplaining to the militant. But after 9 crunchy years fighting inflation, Mrs. Thatcher seems to be flirting with sogginess today. Her desire to keep sterling floating rather than link it firmly to the D-mark is uncrunchy too. The Bundesbank, being the crunchiest institution in the country, that is rapidly becoming Europe's soggiest. President Reagan, crunchy, but with a sentimentally soft centre. Munchy, perhaps. A crunchy policy is not necessarily right, only more certain than a soggy one to deliver the results that it deserves. Run your country or your company or your life as you think fit, but whatever you decide, keep things crunchy. That's Nico Colchester. First published in 1988, it's a timeless message, a message that we've got to take definite action and know what the consequences are. Stand up for them. Accept them. Don't try and blame others or mitigate the risk and pass it off to everyone else. Make a decision, stick to it, stand by it, and man up. I'll be back.
Keep listening. This
Welcome back. This is your weekly dose of common sense. Thanks for staying with us. I'm going to wade in, no pun intended, one of the most contentious water schemes ever conceived in Australia's history. And it's one that continues to rear its head every time there is a severe drought because it's seductive. It's about taking water where it's abundant and putting it where it isn't. It would open up vast swathes of agriculture. It would allow us to repopulate or populate inland Australia. But when it was conceived, it was also about changing the climate. It was the very first climate change scheme, which has wasted so much money and continues to capture the imaginations of people. Of course, I'm talking about the Bradfield scheme. It was in 1938 when it was first put forward by JJC Bradfield. And it proposed basically the constructions of a number of dams to divert the waters from the Tully and Herbert rivers, combine them with the waters of the Upper Burdekin River, and pass the whole lot across the Great Dividing Range, with the object of utilising them in a vast irrigation project in Western Queensland and flowing down into Lake Eyre in South Australia, where a full Lake Eyre would change the climate. It would make it cooler. It would evaporate, it would make it cooler, it would make it, you know, usable, and we would suddenly be able to play God. Well, it doesn't quite work like that. It didn't work in 1938. Bradfield's whole calculations were thrown out. There was a massive critique of it, I think, in 1947 by a chap named Nimmo, who went through it and dismantled a whole range of the points that are put forward. And people who keep talking about the Bradfield scheme, are referring to the proposal in 1938, which was a climate change scheme, which depended on things that were not possible at the time, not viable, not feasible, and are still basically uneconomic. Now, many of these advocates for the Bradfield scheme will actually have a completely different idea in mind, but none of them have been able to articulate exactly what it is, to my knowledge anyway, or cost it. Now, the use of dams, yes, all good and valuable, but details do matter. So do you want to build more dams? Yes. Would it be good to get more water into other areas of the country? Yes. All good ideas. But they have consequences, and the consequences are important. So rather than try and replicate or, you know, mythologize this great climate change scheme of Bradfield's, we need to be a bit smarter about it. So let's talk about some of the issues that were identified with Bradfield's scheme. Firstly, I've got to say, he wanted to construct a dam on the Tully River and then divert the water through an open cut to the headwaters of Blunder Creek, a tributary of the Herbert River. He wanted to construct a dam on the Herbert River and the diversion of the combined Tully and Herbert waters by means of a tunnel 13 miles long to the Upper Burdekin River. Then he wanted to construct a giant dam on the Burdekin River at Hell's Gates. It's a great name, Hell's Gates, with the object of backing the combined waters of the three rivers up the Clark River to a point where it could be taken off in a tunnel through the Great Divide and discharged in the Upper Flinders River. It should be noted that although the reservoir, and I'm reading here from Nimmo's report, it should be noted that although this reservoir would actually contain enormous quantity of water, it would not be available for use in so much as only the topmost few feet would be drawn off through the tunnel. Then, water received into the Flinders would be stored in a number of smaller reservoirs taken thence through an open cut to Skeleton Creek and thence to the Thompson River. And from the Thompson, the waters would be used in irrigation and diverted to other western streams. Anyway, Nimmo, in a relatively brief report, 10 pages or so, details all the problems with Bradfield schemes, that the assumptions are wrong, the water flow rates are wrong, the ability to construct dams, you know, the physical feasibility of it and the size of them are wrong, the estimated water flows are wrong, Lake Eyre would not be permanently full, the climate would not be changing, and so on and so on and so on. Now, some of those things would have changed, of course. Technology has has improved things. But the whole idea of pumping billions of litres of water uphill, then to let it run downhill again, is flawed. There may be different ways, and there may be alternative schemes about redirecting water, but they do have consequences. And why is it that the same people who say Snowy 2.0, which is where they pumping water uphill and letting it run downhill again to generate electricity, and they keep repeating the process, is dumb, and I'm one of those who just says it's just silly, this is another government boondoggle that's not going to work for us, are so keen on pumping water, expensive water, it's very expensive, pumping water across the Great Dividing Range. It doesn't make a lot of sense, particularly if the original goal is to put it into Lake Eyre to change the climate. Now, those who say we want the Bradfield scheme are in love with the idea of redirecting water, and that's maybe a laudable aim. But let's go back to it. Details actually matter. Bradfield scheme is not feasible. It's not practical. It's not realistic. It's been described as a pie in the sky thing. And there are other consequences to it too. If you take a whole range of water, a vast swathe of water that used to run out to sea, you impact how that sea is going to be producing as well. Because many, many sea creatures and fish that we come to rely on for consumption and for our commercial fishing markets and for biodiversity are dependent on those water flows for, as part of their breeding patterns. Now, if you take those influences away, what are the consequences of that? Now, I'm no rabid greenie, you know that. But every decision, particularly decisions of this magnitude, have incredible consequences. I suppose a whole bunch of people thought it was a good idea to bring rabbits here and the cane toad and so forth and so forth, but they have consequences. And there are consequences to grandiose schemes like this. And for those of you who, you can take me to task on this, I don't have any doubt, but for those of you who say government should be doing these nation-building infrastructure projects because they're important, I point you to the most recent one, the NBN. It's so important. It was going to cost $6 billion. And now it's somewhere up into $60 or $70 billion. And it's not working as well. Alternative technologies are available. Commercial opportunities are available that have made the NBN what many would say is a white elephant. And in the end, taxpayers, your government and taxpayers' money will be written off to the tune of $30 or $40 or $50 billion of the total $70 or whatever billion it's cost. Mark my words, the NBN cannot earn a commercial rate of return. So that means either you have to pay more for your compulsory connection, because it pretty much is compulsory, or they're going to have to write down the value of your investment. Either way, we've been dudded. By it. Dudded. And so now we're going to build another scheme. Go, have a look at the submarines in South Australia. Another government boondoggle. Yes, we need a manufacturing industry here. Yes, we need to build things in Australia. Yes, we need submarines. But we are pioneering a brand new version of a submarine that's costing us two or three times as much as the alternative. Why, oh why, oh why? Are we that flush with money that we can afford to do these things? I think the submarine contract will be one of the most outrageous costs ever. So every time someone says the government should build something, should invest in this, trust me, it's going to cost us twice as much as they tell you. And it's not going to be value for money. That is the lived experience. And so when you want to start talking about the Bradfield scheme, think of the consequences attached to it. Ask about the details, because the Bradfield scheme itself has been repeatedly debunked. It was the original climate change scheme. Let's cool the climate in Central Australia, create a nirvana, a utopia for all of us. It's not practical then. It sounds even more unrealistic now. Let me know what you think. Corey at CoreyBernardi.com.
Dose of common sense. with Corey Bernardi.
Welcome back. It's time for your say, and in keeping with the tradition, these have just been put in front of me, so I'm going to be making up my answers on the sly. T sent me an email. It says, Corey, do you not agree that government should go into debt if it is to build essential infrastructure and services? Surely you would agree to keep Sydney moving, that Conservative government is right to go into debt as long as it's manageable while having a AAA credit rating, which is rare among state governments around the world. Well, T, I go back to what I wrote last week. Debt doesn't matter until it does. And debt is maybe extremely affordable at the moment when you can borrow money at 1 or 2 or 3% if you're a government. But what happens when debt becomes 4 or 5 or 6 or 7%? What happens when the mendicant state, when the welfare state that is growing in this country becomes such a burden that there are too few taxpayers to repay it, to pick up the slack? What happens then? There's an estimated something like 90% of the debt of the United States of America is in a trillion of dollars. 90% of the debt is the accumulated interest on previous debts. It's like there's no intention to pay it back. I stand by it. Debt doesn't matter until it does, and then it cripples you. It hijacks you. And if you want to invest in infrastructure projects, then there are ways in which you can do that without incurring debt. You can do it on a commercial basis, or you can invest in one infrastructure project, pay that back, and then invest in the next one, and the next one, and the next one. You know the Ponzi scheme has to end eventually. T, maybe we won't be around to see it, but our children will have to pick up the tab. Jean says, Dear Corey, since APRA has put through legislation to allow banks to confiscate depositors' funds in case the bank becomes insolvent, is there any need for alarm? Are there any steps can be taken to shield oneself from this? Well, this is the old bail-in laws. Yes, there is a provision for that to keep them solvent. Your savings in each bank are protected up to $250,000. So don't go over that limit. You should be okay. Ulrich, who defines conservatism? Who defines the true or moral and prudent? The eugenics movement in the US and Europe, with its acceptance of social Darwinism before and during World War II, would have strongly claimed these virtues, and so on and so on and so on. Look, the real point here is things have changed and evolved over the course of time, but Western civilization has really been built around the true, the moral, and the prudent that has been defined by New Testament Christianity. Do unto others as you want them to do unto you. Respect the sanctity of people's lives. Do not cheat and steal and commit adultery. I sound like Israel Folau now. But speaking of that, you should be supporting Israel Folau, because whether he's right or wrong about his contract, the fact that the pylon from the Rainbow Mafia is extraordinary. As one wag said to me the other day, you know, these militant rainbows, or militant rainbow activists, I should say, they just wanted to be treated as equal, apparently, and now that they are, they want to dominate and force everyone to be sort of slavishly adhering to their view of the world. You're not allowed to disagree with them. You're not allowed to have any opposition to them. It's crazy. So Israel Folau, you should support him. I think the Australian Christian Lobby is running something there, so if you want to chip into his legal fund, do it to smite the left. But that's what it's been about. It has been historically, and you don't have to be a person of faith to understand the role that has played, and that's how we engage in and interact with each other. They are the eternal truths. Treat others as you would like to be treated. Treat them with the dignity and the sanctity that we believe life should be. At the moment, I think life has been devalued. Devalued at a rate of knots. And I feel for it. I feel that we are on the cusp of a regression as a result of progressive politics. Kevin says, whatever your choice, congratulations to you and the Conservatives. Thank you for your service to common sense. Well, the media commentators in the coalition may believe the quiet Australians have spoken out for tax cuts. I believe they chose the lesser of two evils, wanted to ensure the Labor Party did not go into government no matter what. Well, that's probably true, actually. I think Labor lost the election. What we are now facing reminds me of sacking of Gough Whitlam in the election of Malcolm Fraser. which was given a huge mandate to do good. Instead, he sat on his hands. Well, I personally think the government will actually try and do some stuff, and they need the support of the Senate. Anyway, what's happened here is Kevin has said, this is what we need to do. The price of electricity, need to do make our resources against the climate change, immigration and globalisation of the UN. Yeah, border protection, yeah. We shouldn't have a fire sale of foreign assets to multinationals and foreign countries. I agree. Nuclear energy must be adopted. Yeah. Building modern coal-fired power stations is essential. Yes, it is, but I don't think the government needs to do it. Private enterprise can. Water security has been ignored. I don't know. They can't take the water anywhere. Anyway, no longer can we accept the ideological brainwashing of our children through the warped education system. Yeah, I agree with you. A dependence on foreign tankers for oil, petrol, diesel, jet fuel and bunker, etc. is absolutely right. You know, as I was coming in to record this, I was listening to my current colleague, good friend, John Wacker Williams, New South Wales Senator. He was on a South Australian radio show talking about this very issue. And he said that in Western Australia, a couple of years ago, he heard a story about a contaminated load of diesel fuel had arrived there and it had to be sent back. And that meant they didn't have a replacement. Now, in the event, they had, I think, 4 or 5 weeks' worth of fuel available. But imagine that. Imagine if the importation of diesel was somehow stopped because of tensions in the South China Sea or global war or something like that. Imagine the refining capacity that exists in Australia today was suddenly commandeered by the government for essential services, military or perhaps transport. What would happen to the trains? What would happen to the trucks that are delivering our goods? What would happen to the tractors that are running our farms? What would happen to the two-rack tractors that are driving around in our city running on diesel fuel? Imagine how crippled we would be as a nation. Vast distances without aviation fuel, without diesel, without other fuels that we need to sustain ourselves. A strategic oil supply, a strategic refining capacity, I think are absolutely critical. It's all good and well when the world's at peace. But as John Williams said, if there's a war, we can be cut off and isolated. Just remember, one of the largest military nations is just on our doorstep, and they've militarized the South China Sea, a strategic shipping route that's important, critically important to Australia. So, Kevin, you're right. This is a big issue, and so are the other issues you've raised. And yes, I will be helping all Australians and South Australians by constantly reminding the Coalition that they need to deal with these matters because it's just common sense. That's it for your say. Send me an email for next week, corey@coreybernardi.com. I hope you'll tune in then and I hope we'll get to discuss the things that are important to you.
This is the home of the conservative revolution. This is your weekly dose of common sense with Corey Bernardi.
Friends, thanks for staying with us. This is your weekly dose of common sense. And I have to tell you, I got so much feedback about the piece a couple of weeks ago about Fabians and Fabianism and the threat that it posed. And so I'm going to explore a whole range of isms going forward so we can better understand what we're up against. But one wag sent me what I thought was a pretty clever little ditty this week. Ditty? Is that the right word? I don't know. Anyway, mention Kenny Rogers. So that always gets my attention. Go-to song at karaoke, The Gambler. Anyway, he said, finally, he says, in the Kenny Rogers hit song, Coward of the County, it's the late 70s for you youngsters, the last line in the first two choruses said, son, you don't have to fight to be a man. It was about a guy in a barroom brawl. Son, you don't have to fight to be a man. It was a worthy principle in benign times of order, functionality, and good inheritance. Isn't that a great turn of phrase? Good inheritance. That's what we should be striving to do. Make sure we leave a good inheritance. Anyway, digress. But in the last line of the third chorus, after evil has infiltrated or men of bad will have acted and made their intentions clear, the applicable principles change, and pertinently so. So instead of Kenny Rogers saying, son, you don't have to fight to be a man, He says, sometimes you gotta fight when you're a man. And the same needs to be said of conservatives, Christians, classical liberals, and many libertarians when the freedoms and sovereignty that they so dearly cherish is under constant and increasing attack by illiberal, post-nationalist ideologies and their agents for change, which are inhabiting almost every institution in this country and right through the Western world. We've got to be aware of this. We've got to be prepared to fight back in however manner, whatever manner is appropriate for people who are seeking effective change. And I said earlier in this podcast, and I want to remind you of it, the spear tip in this culture war is not a single point. It may be more than a trident. Some will do it in politics. Some will do it in the media. Some will do it in their family. Some will do it in business. Some will do it through financing. But we all have a role to play. You know, we should be doing whatever we can to each our own of our means. We should be doing whatever we can to advance the cause of liberty, of freedom, of traditionalism, of decency, of common sense. But you know that. That's why you're tuning in. So we'll see if we can get Kenny Rogers on the line. No, he won't speak to us today, but beware of it. Coward of the county. Sometimes you gotta fight when you're a man or a woman or even a transgender. I'll be back.
Listening. This is your weekly dose of common sense with Corey Bernardi.
Well, that's it for another podcast. It's always a pleasure bringing it to you. I hope I've prompted some responses from you. I know many of you will be happy or unhappy with some of the things I've said on this. Let me know, Corey@CoreyBernardi.com, because it's important. This podcast is about you. It's about your views and me sharing my views. It's about decency and common sense. That's what we're trying to do. So tell me what you want and we'll go down the path and we'll see if we can explore it. We'll have some isms to deal with next week and I hope you'll be tuning in. Thanks for listening.
This is your weekly dose of common sense.